So as we kick off this week of exploring the theme of ecological science at the frontier, it's my pleasure now to formally introduce the president of ESA to you, and Dr. David Inouye, who will be presiding over this session. Looking for a cue. I think I'll just proceed. Okay. He will be presiding over this session. So let me tell you a little bit about David Inouye. Dr. David Inouye is a plant ecologist. He is professor emeritus in the Department of Biology at the University of Maryland, right down the road from here. His pollinator and wildflower research has encompassed pollination biology, flowering phrenology, plant demography, and plant-animal interactions in both the United States and abroad since 1971. David's been associated with the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab near Crested Butte for over, or nearly, I guess, about 44 years, full 44 years. He has discovered that the wildflower growing season has increased by 35 days since the 1970s. His research in this area is really helping people to understand the impact of climate change in high altitudes. David is currently the lead author of the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services Fast Track Assessment of Pollinators, Pollination, and Food Production. He also sits on the governing board of the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign and the USA National Phrenology Network. David's an elected fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and has been recognized with numerous awards from the University of Maryland. Just to name a few, he has received an Outstanding Teacher Award, a Distinguished International Service Award, and the University System Maryland Board of Regents Faculty Award for Mentoring. He received his PhD in zoology from the University of North Carolina and his undergraduate degree in zoology from Swarthmore College. Now, he has had such a distinguished and very prolific career, but through it all, he has been quite active in the Ecological Society of America. David, in addition to being the president of ESA this year, also served as the secretary of the governing board for two terms. He was a member of the Historic Records Committee and the Publications Committee, and he also was the chair of the former Metropolitan Washington chapter. I think most notably, many of us know David Inouye because he is the founder and the moderator of Ecolog L, which I believe that listserv is now approaching probably 20,000 subscribers from more than 60 countries. So it's just an amazing listserv. It's really been a pleasure working with David Inouye this year. He has been a steady guide as ESA examined its publications program and began a very comprehensive and detailed process to enhance our highly regarded journals and secure their future for their excellence well into the future. His interest in ecology globally has resulted in a strengthening of ESA's ties with other ecological societies around the world. And in fact, we will have an attendance of about 15 representatives from global ecological societies at this meeting. It's my pleasure to be turning this plenary over to David Inouye, who will be presenting his presidential talk, Natural History, Long-Term Studies, and ESA. And he will preside over the morning session, and I understand he has a very special surprise for us later in the morning, so we'll all wait for that. So join me now in thanking David Inouye for his service as the president of ESA.
Okay, at least the slides are working. I'm really honored to be here today, standing in front of you, members of the Ecological Society of America. And I get my 15 minutes of fame now, literally 15 minutes on the schedule. And what I want to do is tell you a little bit about what the ESA has been doing in the past year, a few minutes about my own research, and something about the Ecological Society of America, and finish up with a few words about how you can help the Ecological Society as it moves into its next century. So I could have the next slide, please. Hold your hands up. How many of you have never held in your hands and read a printed copy of one of the ESA journals? Well, not quite as large a number as I thought it might be. All the young people must be sleeping in this morning. But what I wanted to do is make the point that that things are changing. The Ecological Society was faced with the question of what to do about its publications with this rapidly changing landscape of digital publication. And as I had to find a home for my 40 years of printed copies of Ecology, other than the recycle bin, I thought a little bit about the future of ESA publications and the fact that they're a lot more portable now than they used to be. Next slide, please. However, despite our long-term record, I have to point out that we aren't the oldest publication in science in the world. So the title on this, or the subtitle on this, Philosophical Transactions of Accomplishments of the Undertaking, the studies, the labors of the indigenous in many considerable parts of the world could also have been a subtitle for some of the ESA publications. Next slide. Some of the accomplishments of this year that you'll be hearing more about during the meeting, planning for the centennial, that was a long, laborious, and I think very successful process. We welcomed four new sections this year. We've ended our 100 years of self-publishing and picked John Wiley & Sons as a publishing partner. And as of January 2016, our journals will be produced through this new partnership. We've also been strengthening ties with other ecological societies, as Catherine mentioned. And I hope you'll all help to welcome the international members of our society who are here attending this meeting. Next slide. There are a number of programs that the Ecological Society of America carries out on your behalf, on our behalf, and I thought I'd just mention these programs. The Office of Science Programs this year was headed by Valerie Evner and Cliff Duke, and they carry out a broad range of activities in support of us, of members of the ESA, on behalf of the whole scientific community, and also on behalf of public agency scientists and decision makers. And some of the activities this year include a number of workshops you can see listed here. The IPBES, the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, which ESA has been helping to advertise and recruit members and reviewers. And Issues in Ecology is another important aspect of the Office of Science Programs. Next slide shows another office. Next slide, okay. Office of Education and Diversity Programs, which was run this year by Julie Reynolds and Therese Murad. And the SEEDS program is a program that I think all ESA members are now aware of. A number of you have been strong supporters of that component of ESA's Education and Diversity Program, and I hope you will continue to be in the future. An exciting piece of news about that program this year was the awarding of a large grant from the National Science Foundation. And I think that last slide that's now disappeared listed some other accomplishments. Okay, I'll move on with this one. The Public Affairs Office this year was headed by Scott Collins and Allison Mize. And one of the duties of the president is to help put out on your behalf a number of letters sent to policymakers. And so I think I've signed at least 32 letters on your behalf this year. I also participated in the Climate Science Day, which was organized by this office on Capitol Hill. I went around to lobby with senators from both Maryland and Colorado about the importance of funding climate science and STEM funding for the nation. And the Public Affairs Office also tries to foster engagement by all of you in policy and science communication through opportunities like the Congressional Visits Day, where four ESA graduate students were funded to come to Washington, D.C., learn how to lobby and take their message about the need for federal support for STEM research and education to Capitol Hill. And a number of press releases have been published about research, perhaps from some of you in the audience, as a way of trying to share ecological information through a variety of channels and get the word out about the important work that is done by Ecological Society of America members. Next slide. I want to know, have everybody stand up if you've been a member of ESA for at least 5 years. Okay, looks like we've got more than half the audience here. How about if you've been 10 years or more, still stay standing? 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, people still standing, 35 years, 40 years, 45 years. Dennis Knight is still standing. Alan Salomon is still standing. I think it was an idea that I got by attending the British Ecological Society's meeting to try and recognize how long some people have been members of the society. So this year, one of the many badges that you may see underneath name tags is numbers of years which you've been a member. I happen to know exactly how many years I've been a member. The next slide, please. Next slide. When I was cleaning out my attic this year in preparation to moving out of the house I've been in since 1976, I found a canceled check from 1st of November 1974, which I wrote to the Ecological Society of America for membership. So I know I've been a member for at least since 1974. Next slide, please. Okay, I want to tell you a few minutes about what I do. Catherine mentioned some of the subjects that I've worked on, but this has been my research home for 45 years, the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, which is a research facility on the western slope of Colorado. The next slide. Why am I showing a picture of Phoenix, Arizona? Those of you that were in the Crossroads performance yesterday here in this room actually may have noticed this slide appeared in that multimedia presentation that we heard. And that dust is blowing from Colorado, from Arizona and other parts of the Four Corners area up into my study areas in Colorado. The next slide. It gets deposited on the snow there, and you can see how dirty the snow is on the mountaintops here outside Crested Butte, Colorado. The next slide shows a cross-section of the snowpack showing the deposition of that dust during snowstorms. And the next slide, what it does is cause that snow pack to melt a couple of weeks earlier than it would otherwise. And back in the days when the snow used to melt around the 1st of June and the last hard frost happened around the 10th of June, it didn't make much difference that the frost events were happening in June because plants had only just gotten started and they weren't affected by the frost. But now, this year, for instance, we had flowering on the 1st of April. But we're still likely to have frosts around the 10th of June, and that means that frost damage is likely to be a much more common event in Colorado than it used to be. This is also happening actually around the world now. Michigan lost its cherry crop last year. Pennsylvania lost its apple crop. There were losses of wine grapes in Canberra, Australia, in Chile, because of these early spring warming events that trigger early development of plants, and then they get hit by frosts. So here's a picture from the 13th of June in 2001 at my study site showing that the vegetation was already pretty well developed when that frost event hit. Next slide. One of the plants that I've worked with for decades now is this sunflower, Helianthella quinquennervis, which is sensitive to frost. The next slide shows you how common that plant can be in front of Gothic Mountain at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. The next slide shows the same study site, the same time of year, in a year in which there was frost damage. Where'd all the flowers go? They were all killed by frost. These are long-lived perennials, though, so they'll come back the next year. Next slide. One of the simple-minded things ecologists can do is to count. And so I do an annual count of how many of these sunflowers there are in a couple of permanent plots. I've done that since 1975. And if you sort of squint at that, it looks like they're cycles. And this makes the point that it really takes long-term studies to get the big picture. I've been fortunate enough to have some funding from National Science Foundation's program in long-term research and environmental biology, for which I had to write a decade-long research plan. And as you can see here, it really takes a decade-long perspective to see at least one cycle in this kind of graph. The next slide. What I did in this case was to break my long-term study set data set into 8-year intervals, and to try and make the point that you can pick 8 years in which the trend is going in one direction, then another 8 years in which the trend is going in the opposite direction. And the line overlaying over this, showing that there seem to be these cycles, actually comes from the next slide, which is from a paper describing decadal component of precipitation patterns in the Rocky Mountains. So the second graph there, the second line down, shows the data for central Rocky Mountains. And that seems to match what I'm finding in these counts of flowers. So here's an example where, just as many of the early members of the Ecological Society were doing natural history, they were laying the groundwork for very important studies. Very important ideas came out of that simple natural history. And we're now benefiting from some of the records of those early naturalists, because we can go back and repeat their studies and see how are things changing in the context of climate change, which is something that they'd never thought of. Next slide. And just as the science of ecology is changing to become more quantitative, we can use simple natural history observations like counts of flowers to then develop models, as one of my postdocs has been doing, creating a stochastic integral projection model using these flower counts and comparing years in which there was frost damage or was not frost damage to look at the demography of this population. Next slide. Another project I work on that involves simple counting but is giving us some good insights has to do with the massed flowering events of this plant, known as the monument plant or green gentian. It's a plant that's pretty spectacular. It flowers once and then it dies. And as you can see here, those plants that are about 5 feet tall are a pretty conspicuous part of the landscape. And that's what it looks like this summer. It's a pretty good year for flowering. Next slide. We've been doing a demography study up at 12,300 feet of this plant, setting out a string grid of 1 by 1 meters and then looking for plants within that grid. We're now following a few thousand tagged individuals that we started monitoring in 1973. Next slide shows the history of one of those plants, which was tagged as a seedling in 1982, and by last year it had gotten all the way up to 4 leaves. And the next picture shows what that plant looked like after 31 years of growth. Pretty small. So these are long-lived plants, and it really takes a long-term study to try and figure out something like the demography of this long-lived, very interesting wildflower. Next slide. Another simple experiment, just that it takes a long time. I planted some seeds of this plant in 1982, and I've been following those. The first one flowered after 20 years. There's some flowering this year, which are 33 years old, and this was right next to a construction site at the Rocky Mount Biological Lab, but fortunately they were able to save that long-term experiment, and I'm hoping that I live long enough to see the last of those seeds flower that I planted in 1982. Next slide. A number of things are changing about our environment. A number of you are going to be talking this week about the changes you've observed that are taking place because of climate change. Here's just one example from a long-term study of flowering phenology, which is the project that NSF is funding at the Rocky Mount Biological Lab. And this is a plant which many of you may recognize because it has an East Coast congener as well, a bluebell. And the next slide shows how the abundance of that plant has changed during the study years that I've been working at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. For the first couple decades, its abundance was increasing, and then the environment changed, and the abundance of that plant has changed dramatically. So these are simple-minded data, very easy to collect, but once you have enough years of data, it begins to show you a picture which you couldn't gain any other way. Next slide. So just as I've been collecting long-term data on wildflowers, I've been collecting long-term data on things like subscribers of Ecolog, and it looks like we might just be starting to peak at this point, but here's a resource that early members of the Ecological Society could never have envisioned, that we'd be able to take advantage of the internet and bring together an international community of subscribers to advertise job positions, to seek advice for field projects, and I hope you'll take advantage of that resource in the future if you're not already doing so. Okay, let me finish up with a little bit about what I think you can do for the Ecological Society to help ensure that its next century is going to be as successful as its first century. The next slide. Maintain your membership. ESA has had a membership as high as over 10,000 people. We're under that now, and one of the things that Monica Turner, the next president of the Ecological Society, is going to focus on is how we can grow that membership. So I hope that you'll be able to help with that. Recruit a new member is another way that you could help our membership grow. Publish in ESA journals. Publishing in ESA journals is going to be a new experience as of sometime later this year. We'll be developing beginning to use a new electronic portal with our publishing partner. It's going to be a new experience for authors, a new experience for reviewers, a new experience for editors, and I think this is going to make the publication process and access to those publications very different from what it's been in the past. One of the benefits that you as members are going to get is free access to all ESA publications as a benefit of membership. And I think that's going to be something that will help to grow our membership. Participate actively in your chosen section and local chapter. As I mentioned earlier, the numbers of sections is growing as people coalesce around particular topics and want to have a home for their chosen focus as a new section in the society. So that's an option if you, as the field of ecology changes, that the number and focus of sections will change. But that will help to give you a professional home within the Ecological Society of America. Volunteer to serve on committees. We rely very strongly on you as volunteers for a variety of purposes, and I hope that you'll feel like you can help participate in your society by volunteering for whatever committee strikes your interests. Participating in the SEEDS program. Some of you will be participating as students in the program, some will be participating as mentors in that program, some will participate as donors to that program, but for every member of the society, there's an opportunity for you to contribute to the training of the next generation of ecologists and to help to diversify the members of our society. Participate in the opportunities advertised by the policy office. So you may be able to go to Washington, D.C. to help lobby on behalf of funding for ecological research. You may be able to help in a variety of ways with the opportunities that the policy office offers you. Writing to congressmen, calling congressmen is another opportunity that anybody here in this room can participate in. You will see people walking around with a purple badge underneath their name tags. Those are people who are donors to the Ecological Society. Those of us who gave $100 or more this year get to go on a cruise in the Baltimore Harbor for our reception this year in honor of donors. And I'm hosting in my suite up on the 19th floor this afternoon, or later this week, a special reception for those of you who have donated $1,000 or more. And there's lots more room in my suite for people who would like to join that reception. And finally, raising local awareness about ecological science. I think that's something that you can do as a broader impact for your research, whether or not it's mandated by the National Science Foundation. Let me give you one example. In Crested Butte, Colorado, there's a summer magazine that's given away to all the tourists, and they always solicit authors. And so I wrote an article about some research I did last summer, putting radio on hummingbirds in order to try and track hummingbirds and find out where the males are going when they spend the night up on the sides of the mountains, and to find out where the females are nesting. And took a few pictures, submitted a text, got paid for the article, and it's generated some nice feedback from the local community and from tourists learning about the ecological research that's taking place at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. So there are many opportunities for you to help expand the impact of the research that you're doing and educate your local community about who ecologists are and the interesting work that they do. I think that's my last slide. And I just want to thank you once again for being supporters of the ESA, for coming to help make this the largest meeting in the history of our society. It's going to be a very successful meeting, and congratulations on our first century. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to now recognize a couple of people who have been instrumental in putting together the experience that we're going to have here this week. One is Carol Brewer, who is the program chair. The other is Nancy Huntley, who is the Centennial Implementation Chair. And the ESA is happy to recognize all of the work that the program chair, Carol Brewer, has done as part of making this such a successful meeting. And so we have a bowl here to recognize Carol's efforts. And I hope you'll all join me in thanking her for putting this program together. Nancy Huntley, who happens to be my sister-in-law, will be speaking for herself and for Carol to make some brief remarks about the meeting theme and program, and then she will introduce Chris Swan, who is our local host.
Thank you. And Chris, I'll ask you to come up here now so you're ready to speak when I'm done. So we also want to welcome you to the 100th Annual Meeting of the Ecological Society of America. We all, 4,000 plus of us, are here to celebrate 100 years of ESA and also to envision and move into the next 100 years. The meeting theme is Ecological Science at the Frontier, Celebrating the ESA Centennial, and the scientific program develops that theme in many ways. The program is large, very large, and also diverse, and we thank all of you who shared ideas or proposed symposia, sessions, workshops, or other events. There are many concurrent events, so you will have to make choices, but you should find plenty of options and also chances to broaden your horizons in ways you might not have expected. There are 5 centennial-themed symposia and a centennial-themed Ignite session, and there are many centennial displays and events. These include histories, explorations of the future, sessions on the interfaces of ecology with other disciplines, and on its communication for many audiences and many uses. There's a new noontime series of lectures, the Centennial Keynotes, on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And there are projects that will last well beyond this week, including historical records, visualizations, videos like the one you saw last night if you came to our opening plenary, and articles that will appear in ESA journals and on websites. We want to thank all of the people who worked with the program and centennial committees to put together this year's program. Thanks to Hal Balbach and Lee Frelick, the program chairs for last year's and next year's program, who helped to build this year's program. And thank you to the ESA staff, especially Jennifer Rehm and Michelle Horton, for essential help with every aspect of this meeting. They have been terrific to work with, We greatly appreciate their knowledge, their patience, and their ability to accommodate new ideas, solve problems, and make things happen when they need to happen. So thanks for coming, and I'll let Chris Swan, the local program chair, welcome you to Baltimore, which he has done a wonderful job of working into our program in a major way.
So let me thank you for coming to Baltimore. Baltimore is a very old city. I'd like to draw your attention to three things. The first is the Maryland crab. You should try and have some if you can. I remember as a child of growing up on the Eastern Shore, we would often come home and there'd be a bushel of crab sitting on the back stoop that someone, a friend of ours, had given us. One would get away and run down the street and we'd just leave it because we didn't feel like chasing it. That's $5 or $10 now that would be running away. So it's no longer, it's a delicacy, okay? And reflects a rich heritage that we have here in Maryland. The second thing I draw your attention to are the various neighborhoods that you can go out and explore. When you take a break from the meeting, Hamden, Fed Hill, Canton, and Fells Point, which are, go that way, and you'll be able to find those. And if you want to not take the long walk, you can certainly take a water taxi. The last is I'd like to thank Baltimore.org for putting together such a fantastic website to make yourself make navigating the city much, much easier. There's also the app, but there's a few apps you can download for Baltimore. I hope you decide to do that. There are many things to do in a very short period of time, lots of walking tours. Like I said, Baltimore is a very old city. There's a lot to see while you're here. I hope some of the resources that have been made available to you by me and Baltimore.org, they can help you out a lot. I also want to thank, you know, I thought this job would be super, super hard and busy, but it wasn't. And that's largely due to the ESA staff. So I'd like to thank them for all of their hard work. Thanks so much and enjoy your time.
When we think about people who are critical to an organization, we often wonder what would happen if that person got hit by a bus and couldn't serve. And maybe you noticed that Chris is wearing a brace on his hand and a brace on his foot. He literally got hit by a car recently, but fortunately survived and was able to carry out his duties as our local host. A number of people who remained standing when I asked how many people had been members for decades, a significant portion of the history of the Ecological Society, are people who have served us in the past as presidents. And I'd like to ask the past presidents to stand so that we can recognize their help in making our first century so successful. I hope you'll have a chance to thank them in person for their service. And looking towards the future, we do have a president-elect who, as of Friday, will assume the position of president of the ESA, Dr. Monica Turner. And where's Monica? There she is over here. So keep an eye out for Monica, and she'll be happy to tell you about her hopes for what she will accomplish during her tenure as president. And as I mentioned, increasing membership of the ESA is one of her goals. Another honor is for me, for the president, is to help recognize the award winners that we recognize the members of the Ecological Society of America. We have an important committee that is chaired by Alan Hastings. He has done that for many years, so you may be familiar with what's going to happen next as Alan comes up to help us recognize those award winners. So Alan and Michelle Horton from the ESA staff, who will accompany him, and the award recipients. Alan will tell you a little bit about each of these awards.
it's a pleasure to be able to recognize all these wonderful award winners. And what we'll do is we'll go through and mention all the awards and the awardees. The first award is for the Mary F. Buell Award for the Best Student Oral Presentation. And as you can see, Mary F. Buell, it's named in honor of Mary F. Buell for his dedication to the Ecological Society and to the younger generation of ecologists. And this is for the best oral presentation at the Society's annual meeting for the one last year. And before presenting the award, I'll mention that the honorable mention for this is for Michael Barber and Dustin Ranglack. And I'll also say that if you're asked to serve as a judge, please do so, because this is something that's very difficult. The award winner is Nina Laney from Dartmouth College for her presentation on top-down versus bottom-up is a function of temperature for Phoris Lepidoptera. And this in this presentation, she developed a novel framework to determine the effects of warming on a trophic web and tested it empirically in the field and found that increasing temperatures increased mortality due to predators, as well as affecting growth of prey insects due to changes in leaf quality. And the judges were impressed both with the use of theory and empirical methods and the ability to summarize past work. And she did a great job of handling questions as well. Let's congratulate. Next is the Commitment to Human Diversity in Ecology, and this is a relatively new award and very important one. It's in recognition of longstanding contributions of an individual towards increasing the diversity of future ecologists. And the awardee is Mary McKenna from Howard University. Dr. McKenna's contribution has been to promoting the diversity of future ecologists by developing and structured ways of engaging meaningful undergraduate research mentoring programs for aspiring minority students. And most of her minority undergraduate students have presented their research at annual meetings of the Ecological Society and other professional societies, and eight of them have won awards for their presentations, which is very impressive. So let's congratulate. The next award is the William Skinner Cooper Award, and it's in honor of one of the founders of modern plant ecology in recognition of an outstanding contribution in geobotany, physiographic ecology, plant succession, or the distribution of organisms. Next slide. Thank you. The award goes to Carissa Brown and Mark Vellin for their paper on non-climatic constraints. I'm not going to read the whole title. It's, while tree species distributions are influenced by more than just seedling establishment and early growth, this study is a model in the use of carefully designed experiments to tease apart multiple interacting factors and urges caution in simple generalizations about factors limiting distributions at different edges of a species range. So let's congratulate Mark and Carissa. So the Mercer Award is the oldest of the awards granted by the Ecological Society, given in memory of a young British ecologist who was killed in action in World War I, and it's given to an author under 40 years of age in recognition of a single outstanding paper in ecology published during the last 2 years. This is a paper where all the authors are under 40, and Marcello Ardon, Jennifer Morris, Benjamin Coleman, Emily Bernhardt, for their paper published in Global Change Biology, and it provides an exciting contribution in the great tradition of landscape scale ecosystem ecology. The work unifies two critically important aspects of applied coastal ecology, nitrogen loading and sea level rise. The authors conclude that saltwater intrusion has the potential to liberate vast stores of legacy nitrogen from past agricultural fertilizer use, leading to ecosystem degradation and coastal eutrophication on a potentially massive scale. Let's congratulate these wonderful young ecologists.